All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this conversation about the German economy and about a book that was published last year on Germany's economic misery and why the country finds itself in a structural economic slump. The book is titled Kaputt, The End of the German Miracle. And it's one book that I can highly recommend to anyone with an interest, not just in the German economy, but in many of the structural changes that nowadays shape economic performance of many mature industrial economies. And I am delighted to be joined today by the author of this book, which is no one else than Wolfgang Münchau. Wolfgang has been a journalist and writer for several decades. Many of us will know him from his time as associated editor and columnist in the Financial Times, but he has for some time now led his own economic intelligence company called Eurointelligence, and he writes a column for the New Statesman in the UK. And in the past weeks, I have also watched him on the Unheard media platform. Wolfgang, welcome.
Frederick, thank you for the invitation.
I am very much looking forward to this conversation because I think it's not just a very topical theme, but it's also, I think what you have is a really great book, which I enjoyed immensely reading. And even if I pride myself, even if I'm not a German, I pride myself following German economy quite closely. I learned a lot from it, which is why I recommend it to a lot of people that I've talked to since the book came out. And I should also commend you for the excellent timing of the book, because if I'm not mistaken, the day after you launched your book, the German government actually collapsed when the Liberal Party decided to leave the current coalition after a few years. So it gave sort of at least a political symbolism to that notion of kaputt. Now, the subtitle of your book is The End of the German Economic Miracle. And I wanted to start by asking you about this miracle and how you would define it. We have the German recovery after the Second World War, the Wirtschaftswunder. And like many other Western European countries, Germany experienced an economic slowdown that marked the end of the post-war recovery. But then we also have Germany at the peak of industrial globalizations in the 2000s, when the country was known as an export juggernaut that could break into markets in all parts of the world and successfully compete, not least in emerging economies. So how should we understand this long stretch of time from the end of the Second World War to peak industrial globalization? Was it one or several miracles? One or several different economic models that powered economic performance? And in your view, why did it or they end?
Well, Fred, thank you very much. The timing was indeed coincidental. I didn't have that in mind when I wrote the book. The German miracle is really a single economic model, but it occurred in phases. It was basically a model based on the industrial production in a number of sectors, mechanical engineering, obviously, of which the car industry was particularly important, chemical engineering, to some extent electrical engineering. There were large companies and there were also mid-sized companies, the famous Mittelstand. It's mostly privately owned companies, often family-owned companies that specialized in certain aspects, certain industrial processes in which they were global market leaders. Now, this was a specialization. Germany was very good at what it did. It still is very good at in some areas of those. The model continued, I would think, it kind of continued to prosper until about the middle of the last decade. And that was sort of the period that I would look at sort of one whole. But there were gaps in this. For example, the early 80s was a period where the model was already in some crisis. The early 2000s was a very big crisis when German competitiveness, the competitiveness of industry in particular, fell. And they chose economic reforms, which were intended to maintain, to sort of prolong that model for another period. And it succeeded in this narrow term. It succeeded to to keep this sort of miracle up and running for another 10 years. So I think the period from 2005 to 2015 was clearly a period of export-led growth, of strength, of sort of economic strength. But you know, I've actually my first book I ever wrote was already in the same in the early 2000s when I said Germany needed to change its economic model because there was so much happening in the world that that is actually the wrong approach to trying to you know give the car industry another sort of lease of life. It would be much better economically to diversify away from it, to give you some resilience, to give us some resilience. But that wasn't the dominant view in Germany. The dominant view was industry is what we're good at, so we have to do whatever it takes to keep it going. And the policies taken was the famous German association with Russia, Russian gas. That was certainly one element of this. The political coalition behind this included the Green Party, and the Green Party insisted on a phase out of nuclear energy. So the compromise was reached to keep, to rely increasingly on Russian gas for energy supplies. That was an important one. The labor market reforms were important to ensure that companies had ensure that the welfare system would not generate disincentives for people to work. That was quite essential for the system. And there was luck. There was a lot of luck involved to keep it. That actually, allowed the model to prosper in that period. One luck was Eastern enlargement of the EU. It gave Germany and a whole sort of access to really low cost labor markets. One other aspect was the supply chain revolution and sort of container shipping revolution that took place in that period that allowed, just-in-time production methods to be optimized. The Eurozone crisis was ultimately great for German industry because it led to a real devaluation of the euro and a fall in the exchange rate without any compensations for high inflation. On the contrary, inflation was very low. So this was another competitiveness. So a number of things sort of came together that allowed this model that was already in some strain in the early 2000s to prosper for a number for a period and to be misidentified as and Germany's performance to be misidentified as success when in reality it was I wouldn't say luck, but it was certainly an unsustainable economic development that we can be successful for a period, but it didn't, it wasn't a resilient version of success. It was a brittle version of success.
Yeah, but do you think is it correct to say that even from sort of the start of post-war economic recovery, was it always the model that Germany was going to run, not just having sort of an export-oriented type of model, but an export surplus type of model, that it always sort of looked for a strategy in order to sell more abroad than to import from more abroad?
Yeah, no, that wasn't always the case, incidentally. That became the case. Germany, if you look at sort of the period before before this century, Germany, it wasn't particularly, German surpluses were not nearly as extreme as they are today. And generally, as I also write in the book, as economists, we're not looking at export surpluses just as some traded stuff, but as the counterbalance to saving surpluses, which is really what the story is. And Germany generated excess savings, the economy generated excess savings, and it did not generate enough investments. And that was a consequence of fiscal policy played a role, that the extreme policy of complete fiscal neutrality that they achieved through the so-called debt brake and the constitutional fiscal rule that was stricter and has been stricter than the European Stability Pact rules. That was certainly one factor, but also the way incentives were organized in the German corporate sector through government, through taxes, through regulation, made it more attractive for companies to outsource production into other part. And the German model was ultimately about, you could describe it as as importing, you know, intermediate goods and kind of sort of assembling the thing, and then with the help of cheap Russian gas, put your made in Germany label off and exporting them for a very high margin away. And that was a system that worked until it didn't. And it sort of no longer does now that China has become, you know, has shifted from being complementary to the German model to being a full-on competitor in many, many sectors, especially in the car industry, where China, you know, is starting to dominate the next phase of innovation, where America, the United States, is no longer willing to absorb these surpluses is very clear now from Donald Trump's threats on tariffs. And, you know, I'm not sure what he will do, and you know, I don't want to pretend and predict this, but it's clear that the environment in which the United States was willing, a happy absorber of saving surpluses of the rest of the world, that environment's ending, one way or the other. So this is a fundamental shift in the geopolitical environment, and also, you know, the need to, you know, to dissave now, to start investing into defense, into other areas, will make it harder for Germany to maintain this sort of surplus model. It is. I always found it amazing that German economists never really discussed this issue very much of the surpluses. And it, you know, the media just, you know, portrayed these surpluses very much as a sign of success. You know, I remember there was one newspaper always talked, you know, it always sort of used sort of football metaphors. You know, Germany was the world's export champion, as though such a character, such a category existed. And you know, there is a, you know, the biggest exporter in the world. It was sort of like a very artificial kind of, you know, trophy. to get us, as though that was a goal in itself, and it became that, and it's and you know, people then characterize import as bad and exports as good. I mean, real sort of like, you know, really sort of economically illiterate type of comments, and you know, it became, people got used to the idea that running an export surplus was the most natural thing in the world. And you know, I remember we having all these jokes about, you know, everyone should run an export surplus, and then this idea which Germans thought was a thoroughly, you know, sensible thing to do for every country in the world, and it's it's something that an attitude that received relatively little pushback in the public debate, but also amongst economists, and I found that was probably sort of, you know, I think countries get sort of into areas or into periods when they sort of groupthink. Consensus. The German society has a lot of consensus, and you know, it's kind of, you look back at that sort of Russian, you know, love-in between the Germans and the Russians. You know, the whole political parties were sold onto that relationship. There wasn't much pushback against this stuff, and you know, I think ultimately a lot of what had gone wrong is a consensus story. It's the idea that, you know, you have a consensus. It's not a society of whistleblowers. It's a society in which, you know, companies, you know, country, you know, got parties form grand coalitions. It's where you know, where the media and the government and industry, they all agree, basically. Also look at the car industry. I mean, the German car industry kind of agreed that, you know, electric cars were not the future. That was, you know, that was obviously, you know, from the streets, you know, they pushed the old model. But it's interesting, you know, being a journalist myself, there weren't any car journalists. There are kind of a lot of car journalists in Germany, as you can imagine. There weren't any journalists who pushed against this narrative. There wasn't a guy saying, look, you know, look at what the Chinese are doing. But what they did, they amplified the view of the industry. They basically said, aha, look at the stupid things the Chinese were doing. That is the stuff that you would be reading in the German media until very recently, who were basically, you know, underestimating the impact the technological change would have on the German car industry. You know, and you know, I mean, I've been writing about this subject for 10 years, and you know, I've come to the conclusion that German car industry has no future. I mean, not in commercial terms. They will still make cars, I don't care about that, but the big money that they earn, and you know, this whole sort of food chain of you know, trickle down of suppliers and service companies and all that will go, you know, when a car service will become a software update. they're not yet they haven't transited into this world, and it's very natural because you know, when something new happens, the media, with our own business, you know, we didn't invent the social media. There wasn't a single newspaper proprietor who even thought about the social media or took them seriously. It's, you know, when something new comes, like the computer, like the internet, this gives rise to new companies, new business models. And, you know, I don't blame the car industry for failing to see this, because this is, you know, the new car is actually a new product. It's actually not a car anymore. It's just, you know, in the book, I think I called it an iPad with wheels. And I think that's better way to think about the electric car than to think about it as a car, because it's not about, I mean, it's just a good example. I saw on X, I saw sort of an example where they have a lot of, sort of TikTok style, sort of short videos. And there was sort of a scene in the United States, pretty horrendous scene of a road accident involving, like, you know, 50 or 60 cars, and, you know, all bumped into each other in heavy fog. You know, if this had been the world, you know, a German car would solve the problem through highly engineered braking systems. You know, that would be, you know, that would be something that Germans were really very good at. But in the future, you would have the cars talking to each other. You know, it would be a software, an AI-based communication system, where you would need, you could probably do with sort of second, third-rate braking systems, because, you know, you have the data. And if you have the data, you don't, you know, you know it before you see it. And therefore the need for high engineering is significantly reduced. And you see how data, you know, I'm a hobby photographer, and I love German technology, actually. You know, mm-hmm. You know, I'm actually a big fan of German technology. You know, I'm a big fan of the Leica camera, which is an absolute marvel of engineering, and certainly of optical engineering. The glass is just fantastic. Now, who would have thought that an iPhone could, or some other mobile device? I don't, you know, they're all pretty good, actually. Who could actually be a competitor? I mean, it's a lot of data in terms of the optical quality. They're nowhere in the league of a Leica lens. But in terms of the software, what it can do, it gets pretty close in terms of the quality. Now, an expert can always see the difference, and a real expert can imagine that they see the difference. And obviously, there are a lot of people who want to see the difference. And that's, you know, we are in this sort of world where, but for most people, it's fine. The modern technology really does the job, and that happens to cars, and that happens to many areas. And the Germans did not invest in this modern world of data, of AI. They misjudged it, just as the car industry misjudged the electric car. You know, I think German society, governments, but not just governments, but it's, you know, successive governments, but also, you know, the media, the, you know, people who talk about the economy, you know, like business associations, economists, economic institute, they underestimated the importance of AI would have on energy consumption, AI would have on our daily lives, AI would have on industry, on industrial competitiveness. This will become a very big factor in the future of engineering and in the future of manufacturing. And we're not seeing Germany being in the vanguard, not as a producer. I don't care actually very little about being, you know, having AI companies, but it is about the use of AI where the real economic value added comes from.
Hmm.
That's not happening.
Yeah. Just to back up a little bit and then come back to what you were talking about just now, because as I get it from your book and what you're saying right now, which is that, so the model that Germany had was for a while remarkably successful. Then it had to sort of deal with a couple of issues that became problematic from time to time. We had the famous Hartz reforms that Gerhard Schröder did in order to at least notionally try to sort of increase labor market competitiveness there. We had, as you said, the expansion of the EU into Central and Eastern European economies, and of course the growth of the global economy more generally, which also helped Germany in order to professionalize its own businesses, not just reaching markets, but also using foreign markets in order to produce more efficiently. What I'm curious about is, so that sort of bazaar type of economic model, I think someone called it once, was pretty successful coming up into the 2000s before the economic crises. But I would think that at the same time, Germany would also continue with its own focus on sort of innovation, investing more in R&D, trying to sort of upgrade that manufacturing structure in order to become more competitive, more successful, generating more goods, not just within traditional manufacturing, but also stepping into other areas. It was the model of Vorsprung durch Technik, as one company famously called it. But that never really seemed to have happened. And I wonder what was it that happened? What was the factors that held back sort of not just the German, sort of not just these German companies, but the German economy much more in sort of going into that direction, being much closer, much more responsive to streams of technological change, streams of services change that happens in the economy?
Yeah, I think probably, you know, some participants in the webinar might have different views on this matter, but I think it had to do with the fact that, or with the political protectionism of large industry. You know, Germany is a country that is, you know, it's a good country to operate if you're Volkswagen or BASF. You know, it's not such a great company for business startups. And in, you know, innovation, you know, in, especially in changing environments, require quite a lot of dynamism in terms of the corporate scene. And if Volkswagen doesn't do the innovation, who else does it? And it's if you look at the network, I mean, there's universities, there are institutes. I think Aachen University has an institute, or used to have, for the research of the diesel engine, and that was, you know, obviously the car industry was heavily invested in this. And there is a whole network of institutes, of research institutes, practical and theoretical, that service this model. There is so this is not a model that works on the basis of, if you were in the car industry, and after I published the book, quite a number of readers who wrote to me, someone from inside the car industry, there's one guy who said he actually put in, you know, e-car engineering plans on a companies, and he got completely dismissed by this by the company that thought it was totally irrelevant. There was a culture that was against this. So it isn't that Germans can't do this. They certainly can. They're excellent engineers. If you look at some of the names, the big names in AI, you know, just the publication list, there are lots of Chinese in there, but there are lots of Germans and French people in particular. They all work in the United States, or most of them work in the United States, certainly the one that wrote to me. So I think that what happened here is the closed shop mentality that has built up in German companies. You know, an example I quote in my book about, you know, the reliance on China, that became also another important aspect that Germany felt it had a special relationship with China, and disregarding security aspects. And you know, there was a senior member, I think a board member at BSW, who left the company for reasons that no one explained. We thought she was fired because she raised questions about the company's China strategy. It is not a country that is very sort of open to minority views in the corporate sector. And you know, we didn't hear discussions in the media saying, or even in amongst companies. I mean, you would have thought if you have three large car conglomerates that are really dominating the scene, you would have thought that one of them might have said, okay, we might have to do something different. But that didn't happen. Mm. Now, there are different strategies. You know, BMW is more into hydrogen and, you know, than the other cars. But it really isn't. You know, I felt that this is where you get off track by following a consensus where views were systematically you know, there wasn't the same kind of discussion, the open discussion about what is technology. And there was Merkel's famous comment in 2013, oh, the internet is new territory for us. That was 2013. I think we were at the iPhone 7 or iPhone 8 already. We had the chairman of VW at around the same time saying there's no space for electric cars in my garage. And, you know, he had a big garage, you know. I mean, if you're the head of Volkswagen, you have, you know, there's Maserati in this garage, there's Bentley in the garage, and also, obviously, there's Volkswagen, Audi, and all the Porsches and all this stuff. So, you know, he would have had a big garage and no space for an electric car. And obviously, that guy, you know, I'm not sure whether he was the chief executive, the chairman at the time, but, you know, this sets the tone. And that's, I think, what happened. If you're not going to be successful in a company like that, challenging attitudes like that. And where do you challenge them? You know, you couldn't do this in Germany. There wasn't any space for you. And sort of that's not what my criticism is. My criticism is not that Germany, you know, is, you know, has in, you know, is industry folks, that people do what they're good at. But it became protectionist. It became closed shop. It didn't open up. And, you know, governments were not willing to let go of industries, which you need. You need to let industries die. You need to let companies die in order to others. When the industry, the German industry, did this diesel scandal, it was a criminal racket. This is a criminal organization that does that. You know, you could have closed them down. I mean, you know, if this had been any other industry, you would have had the police in there and you would have basically arrested everybody. But the German government looked the other way. They actually said so. They said this is something, you know, they're not gonna pursue because, you know, the car industry is so important. So there was a, you know, that was at the latest when you could, this was a sort of a sign of, you know, I mean, they were so profitable. They could have done the investments. Even if they couldn't have done it themselves, they could have invested in this technology. You know, it's like how the UK, you know, when they stopped becoming the world's manufacturer, they started to become the world's investor. You know, at least it's the second best thing, you know, just get a minority share in all these great companies and just, you know, sit back and, you know, and watch your income rise. They didn't do that either. They doubled down on the technologies. VW doubled down on factories in China. That in the end, in a strategy that didn't work for them. So it's, you know, this is something where, and I think this is what I'm writing in the book. I'm not, you know, focusing on policy because that would have required a whole different book, and it's actually quite difficult at the moment to get out of this. You know, I would not, you know, this is not an easy situation being where they are today. There aren't any easy recipes. This is very, very complicated now. But, you know, what I try to describe is how they got into this. And it was, you know, I have to say, groupthink, a denial of, you know, a denial of digital technologies, a general denial. I think you might always got a sense that, you know, I always got a sense when you listen to the guys in the car industry that, you know, electric cars are for girls. There was this sort of arrogance that was behind that, and digital technology is games. This is irrelevant. You know, gaming industry is bigger than Hollywood, and Hollywood is bigger than many, you know, many industrial industries. Kind of underestimating what it would do, and you know, I see this today, and I see this as a cultural thing. There was I write in the book about a German author, a psychologist who is very skeptical of the digital world and who thinks that children should not be social, you know, should not have, you know, be. And that's probably true that kids, you know, we should probably not allow, you know, mobile phones in schools, and I'm all in favor of that. And I think we should probably also not, you know, give kids a bit of time to be children before they sort of become digital people. But, you know, the complete, you know, the idea was that we shouldn't even teach children about the digital world. That was sort of his big ego. It was a big bestseller, and he was once asked, you know, why shouldn't we teach digital technologies like computer studies and at school? He said, well, we don't teach kids to use alcohol and to use drugs, so I should use them to teach digital. That was sort of the underlying attitude that this is something bad, that this is something that needs to be banned, something we need to protect ourselves with. And you know, you look at the EU regulation on social media, digital markets, it is data protection. It's, you know, a great emphasis on protection Yeah, I mean, I would, you know, say, why don't you focus on data security? That is probably a more intelligent thing to do. But protection, it is about, we need to be protected against the bad companies that abuse our data. That is the attitude. Digital is something so suspicious about the digital world. And that has been sort of, that's a cultural thing. And I know, I think it all, this goes back to the 1990s. You know, when the digital revolution, or 80s, when the digital revolution started with the computers. The Germans were actually there in the first generation. SAP, which is one of the few sort of European, you know, giants, tech giants, they carved out a niche in that era and they kept it, and they're still quite very successful. But you know, that was the last company. There hasn't been much else. I mean, you know, Sweden has Spotify. I think that's a great success. The Dutch have ASML. That's a super great success, and you know, but that was an offshoot from Siemens, from Philips.
Philips,
and,
yeah.
And that's a, you know, that's a, you know, we have a few. Obviously, we have talent, but we ultimately that the digital world wasn't a European world, and we kind of, you know, took a number of wrong turns, and Germany was probably, you know, more instrumental in this attitude. The French were kind of more open minded about the digitalization. They actually, you know, they have digital administration. You know, the French state is in that sense significantly ahead of the German states. We're still using fax machines in parts of Germany. The doctor's office still use it, and people tell us that people still seriously tell me that, oh, you have to have it because otherwise signatures don't count. I mean, people still think this, that they sort of justify this to themselves, that there is sort of a reason for this, or maybe a legalistic reason for this. But, and I think they're coming sort of to a real, very slowly to a realization that these things are, that this isn't working any longer, and they need to change. But at the moment, you know, I'm just following the election debate. I don't see this, it's certainly not at the center of this election debate campaign. I talk about migration and as though this is the most important thing, but that's sort of where even those like the CDU, like Friedrich Merz, who actually has talked at some times about these issues. I mean, I heard him talk about the dysfunctionality of the German business. Well, he's actually acknowledging that, but he doesn't, you know, it's all about immigration and stuff that, you know, and his economic priority list. When I saw it, I said, no, that's not going to change. This is, they're preparing for another great coalition for a very similar type of consensus governments. And, you know, I think it will take a while until this is seriously debated.
One thing that comes up very strongly in your book, of course, is that intimacy between various types of political circles and with the business world. And of course, those of us who have followed the sort of bigger and sometimes more academic debate will know, of course, about Rhinish capitalism. But I think traditionally we would think about that more sort of in terms of different regional governments and perhaps sometimes the federal government having a book, is that these intimacies that also have the effect of largely just depressing that openness for change, that openness for people who swim against the stream and want to challenge the consensus within a company or perhaps within a sector. So how did that sort of strong network of political and business alliances formed? Was it always the case from sort of 50s, 60s going forward, or is it more of a recent development that you get these intimacies that become almost as if they are choking change itself?
Yeah, no, that was not the start. No, that developed over the years. You know, Germany was, in terms of its economic development, very lucky to have had this break after the Second World War, because it gave Germany the ability to start afresh. I mean, Mancure Olson's political economy theory is very much applied to Germany and Japan. The idea of a fresh start with no institutions that are holding you back. Germany started the 50s with a very free market and very few institutions. We created institutions like the Landesbanken, which were very much involved in corporate finance, and this was a way for German governments. I think the financial sector is quite central to the way the sort of the range capitalist, you know, the range corporatism worked. because it was, you know, governments had, and politicians were in the boards of the Landesbanken. The Landesbanken would give preferential loans to certain industries that would, it would actually manage, you know, certain, you know, I wrote about the ThyssenKrupp merger. That was a deeply political thing in the Ruhr. I'm from the Ruhr area, so I know a little bit about the corporatist culture that took place. And this was basically a bunch of guys in smoke-filled rooms deciding how the industry should be structured. And that was the role of the Landesbank was crucial in this, in a lot of the German organizations. And you see, you know, politicians are holding the whole sort of supervisory board structure. It's tailor-made for politicians. ThyssenKrupp is now a steel company, but the chairman, he decided to downscale the steel on the grounds that the German economy is pretty much deindustrializing, this demand for steel is falling structurally, and he wanted to cut capacity by close to 50%. And one of the members of the supervisory board was a former SPD chief and foreign economics minister, Sigmar Gabriel, and he was pushing against it. So this is basically a senior representative of politics using the power of the media, because he's obviously very famous, to push against a corporate decision. Now, he failed in this particular instance, but it was very normal for politicians to be in the supervisory board of companies. You know, the Landesbank, and later there are not many left of them, because they took some terrible business decisions. And I think that's also where why the system is sort of unraveling. You know, I mean, you may remember the movie The Big Short on the global financial crisis. This, you know, there was this reference to stupid Düsseldorf bankers in this. And this was Westerly. And they were basically, you know, buying all these. They were the buyers of all these mortgage-backed, you know, CDOs, and because they had three stars, and there wasn't anyone in supervisory board who knew anything about credit markets. They were just popped off with the idea that a triple A credit rating was as safe as a German Bund, I think it's the group think that I was talking about. It's not just a character trait, but it was an institutional thing that it was the banks were over there. We created, you know, labor market institutions, you know, and it started well intended. You know, in the coal and steel industry, especially if you were a coal miner, your life expectancy was not very long. When I grew up in the Ruhr, you know, people thought that, you know, when someone was 60, you know, I'm over 60 now, but people, when someone was 60, people were referring to that person as a very, very old person. And, you know, a lot of people wouldn't live much beyond the age of 60, because when you worked in a coal mine, you wouldn't. So they would go to, you know, they would have a pension, I don't know, in their 50s, in the mid 50s. So they'd have a few more years to, you know, to live. That obviously the situation, and that was a totally justified, you know, and a socially responsible, arrangement. But that's different when life expectancy is over 80, and people want to still retire in their mid 50s or in their early 60s, and this is a different. So Germany created a lot of labor market, structures about coal determination, about the representation of workers, both at corporate level itself and within the companies, but also at the supervisory board level. And so this became much more sort of entrenched, much more so than other countries have done this. And that's why these institutions developed over a period of time. Also the Kreditanstalt für Wiederaufbau, the old, you know, to not, it's called KfW, which is a state-owned bank, plays an increasing role. And what often happened is that, you know, German governments are famously fiscally responsible, but when they needed money for something, they made a phone call to the bank, and the bank would then, the bank would then forward the money. So there were sort of non-fiscal ways to. Mm. For politicians to fund projects, and this is what sort of the capitalist system, what this sort of corporatist system does, and it is unsurprising that these things, you know, they can perform well. My argument is not that that corporatist systems like Germany performs badly at all times. This is not sort of like a, you know, like a, you know, radical libertarian market perspective. It did perform relatively well. It did, but, you know, German system, you know, people have always, you know, same, you know, in the UK where I live, people, there are some people, certainly in the media, who think that France must be a basket case because they don't subscribe to the kind of cultural, you know, free market ideas that people do in the UK. But and they're always surprised that France is performing so well, and Germany outperformed more than some people think. But you know, the system isn't working anymore. It's not just this is not an ideological statement. It just isn't working anymore, and it isn't and I think one would have to say, taking a purely practical view, if it works, it works, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. A system that's based on industry is now deindustrializing. And that requires clearly some thought about why that is and what's to do about it. It's not about whose fault it is. My book is also not saying it's this party's fault or that party's fault. It's not really that. They were all part of it. The question now is how to address it. And I can only say that it certainly more flexibility, more diversification of risk, allowing new entrants into the market is probably something that would have to be part of that, rather than trying to push through with the same old structures. I don't think it's the existing car companies that would save Germany. It would have to be somebody else. I'm not saying who that should be. I'm not calling for another industrial policy. I'm not saying we should now do this. I'm not saying we should put our money into AI or anything. I just say just open it up and give entrepreneurs a chance.
And I think this is also, I think it comes out very strongly in your book, as you point out. And sort of one way perhaps to describe it is to say that the German model seems to have worked extraordinarily well during the era of industrial capitalism in that way. And it didn't matter so much if you had sort of state-owned companies or if you had strong labor unions. I think it's the same experience as, for instance, my native country, Sweden, which is that it worked well. And you can generate competitive companies, you can deliver wage increases that are reflected in productivity growth, etc. And then you get to a point where it's just not working anymore. And you point to a couple of factors, and I think we have been going through them already, which is business political conservatism in the sense of not having these impulses for change and that allow for change either within company or that companies basically go out to market and new companies come in. You also point to difficulties accepting services market development, that the manufacturing first attitude had a sort of choking effect on the growth of services. You point to technology, obviously, is one of them, and a few other factors as well. There is one question I have been a bit surprised about following Germany that I wanted to ask you about. And let me sort of set this up by sort of pointing to one of the companies that you mentioned, which is ThyssenKrupp. I've been following over the past years sort of defense industries and what's going to happen in Europe on defense industry change and consolidation. And ThyssenKrupp has a subsidiary called ThyssenKrupp Marine System that has been on the market. And there was a proposal combining a German state actor plus an American private equity company that wanted to purchase it. And my reading of it was that a lot of people was generally happy with that solution, but it never really came to point because the government didn't want to give an approval to go ahead with it for one reason or the other. And this was, you could have said no to it, but I got the feeling it was just the German government dragging their feet and they didn't want to make a decision on these type of issues. And that's something which I get the feeling it's becoming more of an endemic problem in Germany, that in terms of its state capacities in order to be an effective state and try to do sometimes the limited things that the state can do in order to improve general conditions for growth and for entrepreneurship, that everything has become just so difficult to achieve in Germany. We have this, of course, this famous example with the Berlin airport, but I have friends who are trying to establish wind power companies in Germany, and they get just trapped in Kafkaesque type of bureaucratic procedures where it's just impossible to do anything. And you have one sort of arm of the government fighting another arm of the government. And that seems to contradict at least the popular imagery of Germany as being efficient, having an ordered system for how to run governments and how to run state systems.
Yeah, no,
so
I think
how did we end up there?
Yeah, I mean, I think this happens through coalitions of different parties, people getting their own, you know, priorities. You know, I wrote about an example of a company that from the Netherlands trying to built a business of vertical farming, and they spent 10 years getting through the, and I think failing in the end. After 10 years, they've been in three different parts of Germany, and you know, increasingly absurd objections to their business, and I think they gave up in you know, frustration, because it's, and I've had readers write to this, and to the you know, trying to people trying to set up a business in Germany and couldn't and failed because the bureaucracy got to them, and then they gave up in frustration. And it's also the cost of actually closing down is very expensive. It takes about on average about 3 years of operational costs in order to close down an operation. It's something that, you know, a lot of people just are not willing to do. You know, bureaucracy is partly, you know, it's you know, I think there is an illusion in Germany about bureaucracy. We saw the present government trying to de-bureaucratize, the EU Commission trying to de-bureaucratize, and they usually talk about shorter forms. But bureaucracy is not the result of bureaucrats. Bureaucracy is the result of laws. And they passed laws on, I mean, if you look at the Green Agenda, which Germany had sort of, you know, was a front runner in. If you look at various, you know, initiatives to clamp down on tax avoidance, tax evasion, it all resulted in significant bureaucracy in the system. Now, there isn't sort of a tendency in Germany to gold plate EU legislation, so to try to improve into, to make it even harder, and that is certainly something that they need to look at. But you know, this is not possible. I mean, if you look at just what's happening in the United States, or what happened in Argentina, the way they went on to do de-bureaucratization, the only way to do this is actually to say, okay, there are certain things the state used to do, the state just, you know, we stop, the state should no longer do this, rather than trying to micromanage bureaucracy, because this is not going to get us anywhere. So what I still don't quite understand, that I have to say, why did sort of countries like Sweden or Denmark, who basically labor under the same EU laws, why are they less bureaucratic? And that's something that is certainly interesting. There isn't an additional problem of Germany being a federal state and three level of bureaucracy, certainly an overblown state sector. That is for sure, and that changed over the years. But it is the presence of green parties in government. You know, green parties have, because of their initiative of Green Deal type legislation, they are by nature bureaucratic. And also corporate social responsibility legislation is by nature bureaucratic. If we, the EU's digital legislation, you know, AI regulation, GDPR is massively, as a small business owner, I can tell you, GDPR keeps us up. And it's a highly intrusive and costly regulation. And it was, you know, the European, both politically and the legally, you know, the courts in Europe see the purpose of data protection purely from the perspective of the consumer. The industry or the companies, you know, our interests are not represented. So there has been a shift away. You know, the EU was famously a corporate construction, but nowadays it really becomes much more of a consumer construction, and it's become a pretty hostile environment in some sectors, compared certainly to the UK. Now the UK is sort of done, you know, the UK has actually not done much. the, you know, most of the divergence between the UK and the EU is, has been from the EU side. The UK has basically sort of moved sideways, but not really forwards or backwards. Whereas the EU has had an enormous amount of legislation in the first von der Leyen commission. And you know, it may change now, but it's going to be difficult to undo this. This is the only thing that you can't just, you know, just get rid of the green agenda. They're not going to do that. Everything will stay. They will just, you know, they will just try to manage it a little better. There will be, so I expect very small changes. And I, you know, even, you know, and that's, you know, this is going to be the difficult thing. It requires a political will that just isn't there. Now, that may not, that may change at some point, but it would require, definitely would require majorities. And this is the system when you have permanent grand coalitions where, you know, if you look at the polls at the moment, you know, you're not going to get the majority of the left or the right. The only majorities have to be, everyone gets a little bit.
Mm.
And that doesn't mean, when that is a situation, I mean, Merkel was famously successful as a chancellor. But she didn't, you know, she was not in the business of solving problems. She was in the business of, you know, keeping everyone, managing,
deferring problems.
Yeah, you know, keeping everyone happy, and it's you know, that's a very different mindset.
A final question, building on my previous question, because I'm curious about sort of the abilities of states to actually move and adjust to new political or economic realities and do what they can in order to do it. So we've seen one example in recent years, which of course included fundamental change in Germany, and that was after Russia's invasion of Ukraine and consequences on energy and energy supply. And that seems to have gone surprisingly well in terms of moving quickly import volumes from piped gas coming from Russia to supply of liquefied natural gas coming from somewhere else. I wonder now, and you alluded to it already in the beginning, Wolfgang, now we have a second Trump administration in America, and he, of course, we know that he is particularly peevish about Germany's export surplus to the United States, that perhaps he has a stronger apathy against German export surplus than Chinese export surplus, and that he's most likely going to do things in one way or the other in order to change the ability of Germany to move even more of its export from other parts of the world to Germany. So, will Germany again be confronted with an external change, creating a new economic reality, which just forces us to change?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that is what I see. I mean, you know, I think that if you look at the sort of the timeline of Germany's industrial decline, the first phase was Brexit, actually. You know, it was you know, that was, the UK was at the time not Germany's largest trading partner, but the largest source of Germany's export surpluses. Then came the pandemic that revealed supply chain problems. Then came Russia's war and the energy crisis, and then, you know, came the red-green coalitions. You know, partially mismanagement of the economy. But you know, the next thing is Trump. And terrorists would come, and it's certainly not an environment in which the model can, you know, I mean, they're running very large trade surpluses against the United States, and that is not sustainable. You know, it's not sustainable for political reasons, because if it's not tolerated, then that's what will happen, and there will be tariffs or other things he will do it will end one way or the other. So the question should be, you know, for Germany to discuss is, what is life after exports, you know, after current account surpluses? What is the model in which we don't live from, you know, we still have, you can still have industry, don't you? It's not a life where you no longer produce or where you no longer invent things. It's a different model where you no longer rely on export surpluses for value creation, because that is a world in which others are trying to do the same. We're competing with China here. And they do this on a much larger scale with much more force. We're not really able to outdo them. So it requires a, you know, I always say, you know, I always say this, the solution to all these problems are European. I don't think there is, I think, for example, the one point I keep banging my head against the wall is the capital markets union. that would obviously, if without a reform of the German banking system, I cannot see the funding for any sort of new era of entrepreneurialism to happen. So this would have to come from the capital markets, some venture capital, private equity, and other that can only really effectively happen at the European level. Germany has been not a force in favor of it. Germany's not the only country that has been putting the brakes on. But that is something where one would need to start repairing this. But I think Trump would be, I think that the best response to Trump, by the way, is not to start a trade war, because we're not going to win the trade war against Trump. We are the surplus country. Just remember that. If there's a tit for tat trade war, we will eventually run out of things to tax. He won't. And we were the first ones to. I mean, we're struggling. I mean, last time it was Harley Davidson's motorbike. There may be Tennessee whiskey. There isn't all that much we buy from the United States. Not like we have a lot of U.S. cars coming in. So it's again. But I think the solution to this is to solve the problem, and solve the problem is a dependency, problem on the United States, and we should probably cultivate, a more varied list of trading partners and supply partners, and become, and I think this is far more effectively done at EU level than at national. I don't think there can be a national solution. Germany's too small for that, larger than other countries, but still too small to have to do this nationally. So to do this smartly on the European level would be the way to do this. But unfortunately, we are not united in Europe, so we have different views across the EU. Certainly France and Germany are going in different directions, so that I think is a big problem, and that is why I think the solution to this problem is going to be extraordinarily difficult. I don't have a sort of an easy, I could say what should be done, but to tell you how to do this in practice will be, if you were in charge of it, would be very, very difficult to do.
Very good. Thank you so much, Wolfgang. It's been a great pleasure talking to you, and it was a great pleasure reading your book. And I'm going to remind the audience again that it's called Kaputt, The End of the German Miracle. And we have also put out in the chat function links where you can buy it. Thank you so much, Wolfgang.
Thanks for taking
the time, and keep on doing all your great work. It's fascinating to follow you. And I should also mention that your company, Euro Intelligence, also, of course, has a podcast that you can access on platforms where you usually get your podcasts. And I recommend everyone to follow that one as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.